Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 23rd. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's front page, above the fold, Business Bank Pioneer, Paragon, Going Retail, by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, executives at Paragon Commercial Bank intend to add two local branch offices starting in 2013 as the regional's first business-only lender embraces personal banking for retail customers. Founder and CEO Bob Hartley says the plan is to open a branch in North Raleigh and another in Cary in existing office space to make banking convenient for the retail clients that Paragon is recruiting from an initial list of 1,000 contacts. Paragon currently operates out of a single office on Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh. "We already have a good brand," says Hartley, who launched Paragon in 1999. "Now we want to expand it to include more customers, whether they're commercial or personal." Among personal banking services to be offered are checking and savings accounts, credit cards, and personal lines of credit, the bread and butter of retail banking. By going to local branches and retail customers, Hatley and his lieutenants are significantly modifying Paragon's original business bank model, a design that brought it rapid growth in the years between 2004 and 2007. "We're going to a hybrid. That's the word we've used to describe it," says Paragon Chief Risk Officer Michael Story. Paragon's model in making the retail jump, Hatley adds, is Boston-based Boston Private, a $5.8 billion total asset lender with a well-defined brand. "It has branches, but not of the drive-through variety. It recruits new clients, but also relies on reputational ways of people finding them," says FBR Capital Markets analyst Bob Ramsey. "People understand the brand," he says. "It's more select for high net worth individuals and small businesses." Under the original design, Paragon sought to hold down its costs by operating out of a single office in any market in which it was involved. It did spring up similar business banks in Charlotte and Richmond. Rather than relying on traditional retail customers and their deposits to fuel lending, it took in deposits from brokers, so-called brokered deposits, as a substitute. And instead of opening the tap on consumer lending, the focus was on making loans to businesses. Initially embraced by regulators, the model has come in for added scrutiny since 2008, however. That followed various studies that led examiners to conclude that one of the characteristics of the banks that were getting into trouble across the country was an over-reliance on brokered deposits. Once marking up more than 60% of Paragon's capital core, such deposits now make up 31%. Hatley, a veteran banker who rose up through the ranks at retail banks Wachovia and People's Centura, says the move to retail banking will allow Paragon to eliminate broker deposits in a couple of years. Paragon finished 2011, a year during which it sold off its Richmond branch and cut staff by 5%, putting up a profit of $1.5 million. It was considered well capitalized by regulatory standards. The bank maintains its Charlotte operation, which could be converted to the retail model, but the shift will take place in the Triangle first. Moving forward, Hatley and Story say Paragon won't abandon its commitment to either low overhead or business lending, even as it looks to add branches and retail clients. "In fact," says Hatley, "cultivating select retail relationships ultimately will help Paragon, now with total assets of $964 million, to expand its commercial loan portfolio." Next up, State Clawing Back $50 Million from Vendor, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. There is good news for North Carolina taxpayers, but it comes at the expense of delays in implementing an electronic system that oversees health care for the state's poorest people. North Carolina has won nearly $50 million in cash and in-kind concessions from Computer Sciences Corporation due to delays in setting up North Carolina's new Medicaid claims processing system. Meanwhile, extensive testing on the new electronic platform, which will pay out billions of dollars in claims annually to more than 1.5 million low-income recipients, begins May 29th. The final go-live date is July 2013. Al Delia, acting secretary of North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, says Falls Church, Virginia-based CSC will pay $10 million in cash in punitive payments due to implementation delays. An additional $37.5 million will come from CSC in the form of an in-kind contributions, including contributed work hours, says DHA's Brad Dean. All of this has been negotiated for some time now, Dean says. CSC, which won the contract for the state's biggest IT job back in 2009, was to have started processing claims in August 2011, but received a 22-month extension. A large part of the delay was due to Medicaid program changes, which required additional coding, but part was due to CSC's generally unsuccessful attempt to take a code it developed for New York's claims-paying platform and adapt it for use in North Carolina. The total cost of the contract has mushroomed from $287 million to $484 million, with the federal government picking up the majority of the cost. Medical claims-paying systems are only a small part of the work of CSC, a publicly traded IT integration giant with 91,000 employees and quarterly revenue in the $3.7 billion range. Its largest such client is the British National Health System, a contract on which CSC recently took a $1.5 billion charge for project delays and other problems, says Jefferies analyst Jason Kupferfer. Even so, the company continues to win a new work in the field, its latest becoming a nearly $280 million contract to upgrade the Medicaid processing system for the state of Maryland, says company spokesman Chris Grandis. Attempts to reach CSC's senior manager for communications, Michelle Hurd, for comment on the North Carolina settlement were not successful. CSC beat out the state's longtime claims processor, EDS, now a part of Hewlett-Packard, to win the North Carolina contract. The state's first attempt to replace the system came back in 2004 when ACS, now part of Xerox, won a $171 million contract for the job, only to have it canceled later in a dispute with the Department of Health and Human Services. And now this week's lead article, A Headquarters Play. The Triangle would be home to a much larger firm if Martin Marietta's bid succeeds. By Chris Bagley from Raleigh. Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated could add as many as 50 jobs at its headquarters if it succeeds in its aggressive effort to buy its larger aggregates industry rival, CEO Ward Nye estimates. The headquarters on Wycliffe Road in West Raleigh could grow by about 25% following an acquisition of Vulcan Materials Company, Nye says. The employment count there now stands at 206. In announcing Martin Marietta's hostile takeover bid on December 12, Nye said the combined company would consolidate its headquarters in Raleigh while maintaining a significant presence in Birmingham, Alabama, where Vulcan is headquartered. I would certainly see a more significant and more robust corporate headquarters here, Nye says of the Raleigh headquarters. It would simply have to be. Vulcan is a considerably larger company than we are. Martin Marietta owns its two headquarter buildings, occupying all of one and about one quarter of the second. It would expand within the second building, Nye says. The positions created in Raleigh would include accounting, finance, and other office-based jobs. Nye says the 50 potential jobs here don't translate directly into the number that would be cut from the 400 or so now at Vulcan's headquarters. We're going to look to hire the best of the best, Nye says. Nye also says an acquisition would lend the combined company to use more professional services in Raleigh, including legal and accounting. Vulcan is half again as large as Martin Marietta in terms of revenue, with nearly $2.6 billion in 2011, compared to Martin Marietta's $1.7 billion. But Vulcan has turned a profit in just two of the last 5 years. It is struggling under an annual interest expense of $200 million, as well as a heavy concentration in Sunbelt states where construction industries were decimated by the recession. Nye has framed the takeover attempt as a way for the companies to thrive amid the industry's turbulence, including uncertainty about federal spending on highways, which supports a large portion of both companies' business. The companies overlap in terms of the geographic areas they serve, which provides another potential target for consolidation and cost savings. In Delaware Chancery Court, where Vulcan is trying to block the takeover, Martin Marietta Chairman Stephen Zelnick testified in early March that it would result in more than $200 million in annual cost savings. The offer would trade a half share of Martin Marietta stock for each share of Vulcan. Those terms value Vulcan at $5.75 billion based on its 129 million shares outstanding and Martin Marietta's share price of $88.99 on March 19th. Vulcan's market value climbed higher than the offer value in December and has remained there, reflecting expectations that the offer could be raised. In the absence of a deal, Vulcan's heavier debt load makes its share price much more vulnerable to a prolonged slump in the construction industry, according to independent analysts and Vulcan shareholders who support Martin Marietta's offer. Vulcan representatives' recent statements about the industry's potential for recovery have been much more bullish than Nye's. His offer undervalues their company, they say. Since Vulcan moved last month to boost its profitability through further job cuts in Birmingham and elsewhere, if Martin Marietta is successful with its hostile offer, there would be negative impacts on the Birmingham community, Vulcan spokeswoman Megan Stafford says. Morningstar analyst Elizabeth Collins says Martin Marietta will clearly have to wring out costs to make an acquisition worthwhile. At the same time, the company's executives walk a fine line in quantifying expectations of those savings. They have to convince their own shareholders that they're not paying too much for Vulcan, and convince Vulcan shareholders that they're not paying too little. Inside the front cover, shops, restaurants are luring RDU customers, by Chris Bagley, from Morrisville. A recovering economy and a strong selection of shops are pouring money into our Raleigh-Durham International Airport, even as airlines restrict passenger numbers to remain profitable. That's the take of the airport's managers, who estimate that 4.58 million passengers will board flights at RDU in the fiscal year that begins April 1st, a slight decrease from the more than 4.6 million now expected to board through the end of the current fiscal year. But individual passengers have been spending more while in the airport, so much more that managers expect to reap $6.1 million from restaurants and shops, compared to the $5.3 million they projected during budget season last year. The airport takes cuts of 10% to 15% from such concessionaires' revenue. Folks are eating more, buying more, airport CFO Joe Stiers says. Airport managers say the increase reflects a recovering economy and the unexpectedly strong success of several new concessionaires, including a Five Guys Burgers and Fries, an adjacent deli that opened along with the newly renovated Terminal 2. These concepts have been just blowing away the pro forma numbers. Airport Finance Director Tim Barrett says, referring to concessionaires' initial revenue forecast. Passengers spending in the terminals translates to about $1.52 in revenue per passenger boarding in the coming year, compared to the $1.30 in the current year. All told, the budget foresees $95.1 million in revenue, a couple million more than the airport is taking in this year. Along with newly increased parking fees, this surging concession revenue is pushing the airport's total revenue above the $90.6 million budgeted for the current fiscal year. The budget is the first one developed under the leadership of Michael Lansguth, who took over as airport director in November and reflects shifts in priorities from those of 34-year veteran John Brantley, who retired. The expected increases in concession and parking revenue are helping to cover Langwith's plans to boost spending on technology and employee development. They're also helping to augment tepid revenue from landing fees, which are tied to aircraft weight and ultimately to passenger counts. The budget includes $11.3 million in such revenue, down by $365,000 from the current year's budget. Several airlines have cut flights, and most are shifting to smaller airplanes. Most airlines have made those cuts in conjunction with fare increases, which in turn are meant to offset higher fuel prices and shore up profitability. Independent airport consultant Roy Williams says mid-size airports, such as RDU, are experiencing modest declines in passenger number, while hubs are growing modestly. Passengers who would use non-hub airports to fly short distances often opt to drive instead, says Williams, previously the director at airports in New Orleans and Salt Lake City. Williams says growth in concession revenue is also fairly common these days. Concessions numbers reflect that the economy is recovering, Williams says. Concessions are definitely getting stronger. And now, Strong Thirst for Foreign Workers, by Lauren K. Ossons. From the Research Triangle Park. Ashavini Pavaskar wants to stay. The Marquette graduate in biomedical engineering came to the United States on a student visa in 2008 and was able to extend her visa last year to work at Bioptigen at RTP. Bioptigen CEO Eric Buckland wants to keep Pavaskar, but if she does not get a visa extension this year, an extension that would allow her to stay an additional 17 months, she'll have to go back to India, and Buckland will be out a scientist. I would look for a job similar to this, she says, of a return to India, but the opportunities aren't really there. Opportunities do exist here, so many, in fact, that local companies can't find the highly skilled talent in the STEM curricula of science, technology, engineering, and math to fill them. When they are found, they're more likely to be foreign-born. And here's why. Only 13.7% of American college students study the STEM curricula compared to 36.1% of foreign-born students who are studying in America. Hiring foreign-born students who are educated in America is an expensive and complicated process for a variety of reasons, not the least of which are immigration regulations. Washington can only issue 65,000 H-1B visas every year. April 1st is the earliest that most immigration paperwork will be accepted, immigration attorney Laura Edgerton says. The H-1B process, in which a company sponsors an immigrant, is the most typical way to hire an immigrant with a bachelor's degree or higher in a scientific background. But the number of those visas granted is capped, and it takes 6 months to get an H-1B approval. That, she says, is kind of not in line with the real-world priorities. If you want to hire somebody, typically you would hire them in the next couple of weeks. While H-1B visas are more first-come, first-served, permanent citizenship has a per-country quota, meaning immigrants from large populations, such as those of India and China, face more competition to get citizenship. North Carolina State University economics professor Steve Allen says workers such as Pavaskar should stay here, contributing to the economy, buying houses and spending money instead of being stuck in immigration limbo. These are going to be the people who are going to be creating the next great waves of innovation, and they can't get jobs here, he says. This is just crazy. Additionally, he says, companies that need such employees may be forced to move operations outside of the United States, actually causing Americans to lose jobs. Chimanix A Durham tech management company couldn't exist without its foreign-born workers, CEO Stephen Perry says, adding that legal fees accumulate to about $10,000 per foreign-born employee. Despite that cost, four of Chimonix's 15 full-time employees are foreign-born. One position, a communications and marketing specialist, has been open for more than a year because Chimonix wants someone with a technical background. You can't hire a business major to do this, he says. We go to these career fairs and we get a lot of business majors and marketing majors, but that's not what we're looking for. On the larger end of the corporate spectrum, Lord Corp in Cary has experienced similar talent pool limits. Lord works in military aerospace engineering, and there are limits on what foreign-born workers can access due to security reasons, CEO Rick McNeil says. It's another difficulty in working with immigrants, but sometimes there are no options. Next up, Animal House, the Disneyland of the Pet World, by Jason DeBrun, from Garner. More and more families treat Fido and Muffin as part of the family and want good health care and a growing menu of amenities for their pets. In an effort to grab a piece of that market, local veterinarian Dr. John Strasser soon will open an animal hospital and boarding facility that he calls, quote, the Disneyland of the Pet World, end quote. With a price tag of $3.2 million for the 18,000-square-foot facility, he might not be exaggerating too much. Called Canyon Ranch Animal Hospital and Resort, the facility will essentially offer everything that pets need. That will include veterinary care, boarding, and obedience training under one roof. Located just inside Johnston County with a Garner address, Strasser hopes to draw primarily from Fuquay Varina, Garner, Clayton, and Fayetteville for veterinary care. He plans to market throughout the Triangle and towards Greensboro for boarding services. With Canyon Ranch being about a half a mile off Interstate 40 on NC 42, Strasser hopes to attract beachgoers as they look for a pet sitter during a weekend vacation. Initially, Strasser hopes to build a clientele of dog and cat owners, but intends to open Canyon Ranch to owners of all animals. Tracy Cox, practice manager of Canyon Ranch, points out that some 50,000 horses are in Johnston County, and that the facility would market to owners of cattle and other large animals as well, though that would likely make up a smaller portion of the business. In the first year of operation, Strasser hopes to see 80 to 100 animals per day on average, with the facility capable of seeing 240 animals per day at maximum capacity. From a revenue standpoint, that would translate to gross income of about $120,000 per month initially, with the goal of reaching between $3 million and $4 million in an annual revenue after a few years. Canyon Ranch officials say they have not set prices for the services at the animal resort, but acknowledge that prices have to be competitive to area facilities. As for employees, Strasser will hire 12 to 15 full-time workers with as many as 20 additional part-time workers during the summer. In addition to Strasser, there will be one other veterinarian in the beginning. The pet care market is in growth mode. In 1991, American households with either a dog or a cat spent $7 billion on veterinary care. In 2006, that had increased to $23 billion, according to the American Veterinary Medical Association, which projects that figures for 2011 will also be up when they are finalized. The AVMA produces the study in five-year increments. Similarly, the number of veterinarians in the U.S. increased to 92,500 in 2011, up 14% from 2006, with the median income of those vets increasing to $97,000 per year in 2009, according to the AVMA. Increasingly, pets are viewed as family members, and they get the quality health care that a family member would get, and the family is willing to pay for that, says Dr. Michael Davidson, Associate Dean and Director of Veterinary Medical Services at the North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Quote, that's only going to continue, probably on a pretty good clip for the foreseeable future, end quote. To be sure, many families still see the pet as nothing more, and many animals are still neglected or abused, but Davidson says the category that views the pet as a family member is growing. That's been driven by the human-animal bond, he says. Canyon Ranch is not Strasser's first rodeo. In fact, he's built 9 of the facilities, though none to the scale of Canyon Ranch. He operates smaller facilities in Cary and has ownership stakes with various partners in other practices. For Canyon Ranch, Strasser is the sole investor. Next up, Triangle Business Journal launches Social Madness Corporate Challenge. From the TBJ reports, Triangle Business Journal is on a quest to identify the companies with the best social media chops. TBJ and our parent, American City Business Journals, are kicking off Social Madness, presented by Capital One Spark Business. It's a competition that measures the growth of a company's social media presence as it competes in a dynamic and unpredictable tournament-style challenge. Companies will compete in 43 U.S. cities, with local winners squaring off in a national challenge. 3 overall champions get the right to designate a $7,500 donation to the charity of their choice. This is a one-of-a-kind challenge that we think companies of all types and sizes will be excited about, says Whitney Shaw, CEO of ACBJ. Social Madness is all about growing your social media engagement, which is critical in any business today. Social Madness is a bracket-style tournament challenge in which companies compete against others of similar size. Participants in the 13-county region of the Triangle will be ranked based on a scoring algorithm that measures social influence. The algorithm will track votes on TriangleBusinessJournal.com, LinkedIn connections, Facebook activity, and Twitter followers during the challenge period. Why enter? Social Madness could help your company improve its social profile, increase followers, and gain valuable exposure to Business Journal readers. And if you're one of the 3 national champions, ACBJ will donate $7,500 to the charity of your choice. Today, social media has earned the right to be included in the strategic plan of almost all companies, says Brian Hamilton, publisher of TBJ. Instead of asking why, more firms are asking how, dedicating resources to tap this channel of opportunity. While we think this first-of-a-kind challenge will generate a robust competition among local firms, we also feel it will offer sound ideas and best practices for leaders to share with their teams. You can enter the local challenge in your company's headquarters market at www.socialmadness.com. Companies will compete in 1 of 3 size classes based on the number of full-time employees. Small is 1 to 99, medium is 100 to 499, and large 500 and more. The nomination period ends May 15th. No points are accumulated during the nomination phase. The local market challenges kick off June 1st, first in an open all-comers format, and then as the field is narrowed in a head-to-head bracket challenge. In July, the challenge moves to the big stage with local winners squaring off for national bragging rights in 3 categories based on company size. The final matchups will be completed in early September. Throughout all phases of the challenge, results will be updated every 24 hours, so competing companies and observers alike can track the competition as it develops each day. For more information, including official rules and eligibility requirements, visit www.socialmadness.com. You can keep abreast of the challenge by following this website. And now, bulk of settlements, $338 million to stem pain of lost homes. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Mortgage borrowers in the state who lost homes or stand at risk of losing them will end up receiving nearly 84% of North Carolina's $338 million share on the national foreclosure settlement. But relief won't come quickly. The 5 large banks that agreed to the settlement have 9 months to identify the individual borrowers who will get help, and then up to 3 years to deliver it. They're expected to complete 75% of the work after 2 years, however. North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper took part in the negotiations that produced the February deal, which is worth $25 billion nationally. The $338 million heading North Carolina's way is a best estimate of the benefits Tar Heel residents should see as a result of the bank's actions, says Cooper spokeswoman Noel Talley. Only mortgages on the books of the five banks or their investors will qualify. Mortgages owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are not included. Those banks are Bank of America, Citi, Chase, Ally, formerly GMAC, and Wells Fargo. According to the North Carolina breakdown, $33.5 million will go to borrowers who lost homes between January 1, 2008 and December 31, 2011 through improper foreclosure. The cash payments to be made through a claims administrator are expected to be about $2,000 each, which means that roughly 16,785 of them would go out in North Carolina. Next, $179.5 million will go to borrowers who can't afford their mortgages but could make payments if the loans were smaller. On the menu of possible loan reducers will be principal reductions, short sales, and interest rate cuts. Next, $69.5 million will go to refinance the loans of borrowers who are underwater, meaning they owe more on their current loans than their homes are now worth. And finally, $55.4 million goes for a grab bag of activities, among them $15.35 million for the state's general fund and schools, $30.59 million for foreclosure counseling and legal aid, and $14.34 million to beef up mortgage fraud protection and the state's consumer protection division. North Carolina's share was the 12th largest among the 49 states taking part in the settlement. Professionals working in the Triangle market, while encouraged by the settlement, wonder how much effort it will have. Up to 55% of the first-time buyers in the local market have loans owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that won't qualify, says Allen Tate agent Tom Bowman. Quote, "You certainly hope this helps, but I think we are still going to see some problems," he says. North Carolina budget and tax center housing expert Rochelle Sparko says new mortgage servicing practices outlined in the settlement might well be its most lasting benefit. The banks have agreed to follow them moving forward. Pointing at a spotty record for prior reform attempts, she says it is important for everyone to be vigilant. Next up, versus competition, sales lagging at Triangle Town Center. By Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. Compared to major rivals in Durham and Raleigh, the Triangle Town Center Mall is lagging in terms of sales per square foot, a standard industry matrix based on data provided by the owners. Securities documents filed by mall owner CBL and Associates of Chattanooga, Tennessee, a publicly traded company, reveal that average sales per square foot for non-anchor tenants at Triangle Town Center in North Raleigh were $287 in 2011. At Raleigh's Crabtree Valley Mall, an average store sales are $665 per square foot, says Charles Lanier, director of leasing for the mall's management company, Plaza Associates. As of March 21st, Crabtree had only 3,600 square feet of vacant space. "We've had a really good couple of years," he says. At Streets of South Point in Durham, owner General Growth Properties doesn't disclose individual property sales figures, but its estimates that average sales for its 78 best-performing properties is $575 per square foot. Average tenant sales for its other properties are $505 per square foot. At another local mall owned by CBL, Carytown Center, average sales were $246 per square foot in the fourth quarter. Going forward, Triangle Town Center faces a watershed period through the end of this year. The mall opened in 2002, and 10-year leases are considered standard, though not exclusive, in the industry for small retail shops. That 10-year anniversary is now upon mall managers. Retail Real estate sources say vacancy among the mall's small shops could jump from the current 6% range to more than 30% unless CBL is able to come to terms with those tenants or find new tenants to replace them. CBL officials discount any notions that the mall is facing an uphill task. The Streets at South Point Mall faced a similar fate when it reached its 10-year milestone in early March. Its management team has since announced a number of new tenants opening in 2012, including a two-story Forever 21 store, plus new locations for Madewell, Vera Bradley, and Sperry Topsiders. Triangle Town Center is a very successful center that continues to attract a number of new and exciting retailers, says CBL's Katie Reinsmith. I would note, as you are trying to compare Triangle Town Center with other properties, that our sales calculation is extremely conservative and includes the open-air Triangle Town Commons, which would operate at a different level than a traditional enclosed mall due to store type and sizing. Reinsmith adds that the mall owners are continually pursuing new ways to enhance offerings at the center and bring in new stores and restaurants. Nationally, retailers such as Talbot's, Best Buy, Brookstone, and Victoria's Secrets have been shrinking store footprints or closing locations altogether. United Colors of Benetton, for example, closed its stores in February at both Triangle Town Center and Streets at South Point, and is replacing them with one store at Cameron Village in Raleigh. Hilliard Lyons analyst Carol Kemple noted in a report on CBL that overall occupancy for the company's 157 properties across the U.S. has also been improving in recent months, reaching 93.6% in December compared to 92.4% the year prior. Average sales for small shop tenants for CBL malls also increased by 3.3% in 2011. And now, a new move afoot to tax services by Lise Weisbecker from Raleigh. The old question of whether services, such as installing cabinets, countertops, flooring, and roofing, should come under North Carolina's 4.75% sales tax law is being asked again by state lawmakers. Looking at it is the Revenue Laws Committee, the legislative group that meets to consider changes to the tax code and make specific recommendations to the General Assembly. The next legislative session is scheduled to begin on May. Another change under consideration this year is repealing the North Carolina estate tax, a move that would cost the state about $127 million by 2014 and up to $170 million a year after that, says fiscal researcher Barry Boardman. Opponents of the tax, who have prepared a draft repeal, says it is hurting small businesses and farms. Putting sales taxes on services as a revenue generator for the state is an issue that comes up with regularity each time the General Assembly meets, and one that has found its way into every study on reforming the state tax code over the past decade. Generally, the sales of goods is taxed. Service contracts, painting a house, for example, are not. Cabinets, floors, roofing, and the like fall into a gray area, however. If the seller includes an installation charge in the total on an invoice, the sales tax applies to the total figure. If, on the other hand, the installation charge is broken out as a separate item, it is exempted from tax as a performance contract. The gray area is costing the state money, says Department of Revenue General Counsel Kanan Huey, who provided no specific loss figures. The Revenue Laws Committee will look at a number of solutions, including passing a law to clarify the gray areas regarding cabinets and floors and the like. A second option would be to consider the broader move of putting all or most services under the state sales tax. Senator Floyd McKissick Jr., a Revenue Law Committee member and Durham Democrat, says he believes taxing services should become part of any modernization of the state tax code. The state Senate's proposed code revamp 3 years ago included the idea. But we couldn't get enough of a buy-in then, he says, and I'm not sure there is the political will to revisit it now or not, especially during an election year. Next up, health insurers get a break of $5 million by Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. Health insurers with little market share in North Carolina got some good news from the federal government. Thanks to a one-year waiver, they will owe their customers about $7 million, not $12 million as originally projected. The issue can be traced to the new National Affordable Care Act that requires insurers to spend 80 cents of every $1 in premiums collected on providing health care, with spending on administration and shareholders' payout limited to 20%. North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin feared the requirement would have made it impossible for some insurers to compete, especially because Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina commands a market share of roughly 80% of individuals who buy insurance for themselves rather than through a group. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services agreed with Goodwin, and a one-year period in which insurance companies spend only 75% of the premiums collected on health care. That reduced the amount they would have owed in rebates to about $7 million. While the 80% rule takes effect this year, the 75% provision is retroactive to premiums collected and care provided in 2011. This decision underscores the value of state-based insurance regulation, says Goodwin. The commissioner did not get his full wish, however. Last year, he requested the spending requirements, a metric known as a medical loss ratio, or MLR, be phased in at 72% in 2011 and not hit 80% until 2014. While HHS agreed that applying the 80% rule right away may destabilize the individual market, in North Carolina it granted the waiver for only 1 year, says Stephen B. Larson, the director of the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight at Health and Human Services. When spending exceeds the limits, customers receive rebates from their insurance companies. The North Carolina Department of Insurance estimates the 2011 rebates will total about $7 million under the 75% easing. Had the 80% MLR been enforced, North Carolina Department of Insurance estimates that 9 insurers would have owed $12 million to more than 58,000 customers. In all, insurers collected $1 billion in member premiums on the individual market that year. One way for insurance companies to cut costs by reducing payments to independent brokers who sell on behalf of the insurer. Ryan Young, the Senior Director for Federal Government Affairs at the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of America, says the one-year waiver does little to help. It's a good thing, but it's temporary, he says. Really, it's more marginally helpful. The waiver is really limited in both duration and scope. His group is pushing a bill in Congress that would eliminate broker pay from the MLR formula. Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina, a nonprofit and by far the largest health insurance provider in the state, already meets the 80% requirement. CEO Brad Wilson has actively stayed out of the MLR debate, and in a statement, the insurer said only that it plans to continue spending as much as 85 cents on health care for every $1 it collects in premiums. As a not-for-profit, we are able to focus on our customers' health care needs rather than shareholders, according to the statement. In 2011, Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina reported $177 million of net income on $5.5 billion of total revenue. It spent $4.2 billion on claims and medical expenses that year. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. UNCCH on cusp of new funding round. At a meeting early in 2008, the Board of Trustees of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill talked about when the school might begin the quiet phase of a comprehensive campaign that would aim to raise $3.5 billion to $4 billion. Spirits were running high. In December 2007, UNC had wrapped up an 8-year campaign that raised $2.38 billion, which at the time was the fifth largest campaign completed by any university in the United States. In fall 2008, however, the capital markets collapsed, triggering a recession and prompting the school to put its campaign plans on hold. With the economy sinking and individuals' net worth dropping, donors would have been extremely cautious, and we didn't think we would be able to generate any kind of momentum for a campaign, says Matt Kupick, UNC's Vice Chancellor for University Advancement. The timing just wasn't right, he says. Still, UNC pursued an aggressive strategy for its ongoing fundraising, he says, continuing to meet with people and to share the vision of the institution, and to talk about ways donors' giving could make an impact. The effort paid off. In the fiscal year that ended June 30, 2011, UNC raised $277 million in cash gifts, its second-best annual total ever, eclipsed only by the $301 million it raised in the fiscal year ended June 30, 2008, just before the economy crashed. Now, Kupik says, UNC has resumed internal discussions about launching a new campaign. While no decisions have been made, he says the quiet phase of the campaign could begin within 12 months with a goal that likely would exceed the total raised in the last campaign, but fall shy of the range anticipated before plans for a new campaign were put on hold. It's all very, very early, he says. While UNC receives a recurring annual state appropriation of $470 million, or about 18% of its annual budget, private support increasingly is taking on a more important role, Kupik says. UNC meets 100% of its students' demonstrated financial need, for example, he says, yet there are increasing pressures on money provided by the state and on federal Pell Grants for students. The main priorities for a campaign likely will be supporting students and faculty, including funds to boost the school's $2.2 billion endowment. UNC, which is installing a new software system for its alumni development, also expects new commitments by donors to grow by about $50 million to $100 million a year during the next campaign, says Kupik, a 1980 graduate of the university where he was the starting quarterback for the football team for 4 years. In fiscal 1992, the year Kupik joined UNC as Associate Vice Chancellor for Development, he says annual cash giving totaled $53 million. The school will be connecting donors with opportunities to support strategic initiatives that focus on water and energy, as well as innovation and entrepreneurship, efforts that will give donors the opportunity to have a big impact on critical issues, Kupik says. We can truly have a significant role, he says, in helping to solve the world's problems. Next up, IPO, a no-go. Options now few for Argos. By Lauren K. Assange. From Durham. Now that it's ditched a bid to go public, cash-starved Argos Therapeutics has two choices: find partners or return to original investors to come up with a big chunk of the estimated $85 million that securities documents suggest a Phase 3 trial for Argos kidney cancer treatment would cost. Argos CEO Jeff Abbey confirms that forming a partnership with a pharma that could bring cash and marketing savvy to the table is a way to go, if it's the right partnership. Out of any partnership talks, he concedes, could evolve a deal to sell Argos. Whatever the path, it will be difficult, given Argos's financial track record as outlined in documents filed with the U.S. Securities Exchange Commission. In 2011, Argos reported a net loss of $20.1 million. In 2010, that loss was $9 million, down from a loss of $9.9 million in 2009. Altogether, as of December 31, 2011, Argos had accumulated losses of $128.8 million. Going forward, Argos's documents stated, "We expect to incur losses for the foreseeable future and may never achieve or maintain profitability," adding there is substantial doubt about Argos's ability to move forward. Such losses, of course, are far from unusual for a drug development company, and investors who bet on early-stage drug companies generally are not looking at the losses but at the potential of the drug and how it may be able to replace existing options in that specific field. As with most companies that withdraw IPOs, Argos cited a catch-all phrase, quote, "market conditions," end quote, which translated generally means there were no buyers for what the company was offering, stock in a money-losing biotech with no products. Argos had hoped to raise up to $90.6 million from the sale of the $5.3 million shares, but no buyers. At least not enough of them could be lined up. Not surprising, says Stephanie Chang, an analyst with Greenwich, Connecticut-based Renaissance Capital, who says IPO investors are being more selective in the risks they take, especially regarding the long-term nature of biotech investments. Argos's previous venture capital investors include two Durham firms, Aurora Funds and InterSouth Partners. Aurora Funds own 4.5% of the company, and InterSouth Partners owns 13.2%. Representatives of both firms declined to discuss their past investments or potential future infusions. The bottom line is, Argos needs cash. While a trial for the company's HIV drug, called AGS-004, estimated to complete enrollment this year, is fully funded by a $34 million grant from the National Institutes of Health, a kidney cancer treatment, called AGS-003, is not funded. Abby believes the kidney cancer treatment could be approved from just one Phase 3 trial, an assertion he needs to sell to potential partners or investors. The search for an alternate way to raise funds is a scenario that Chang does not find uncommon in today's market, a market in which more than half of 2011's 125 IPOs opened below target prices. IPO Desktop President Francis Kaskins wasn't surprised that Argos withdrew its filing. "There wasn't enough to look forward to in the filing," he says, adding that the first factor he looks for is whether an IPO-bound biotech has a strategic partner. "If they don't have a strategic partner by now, it may mean there's some problem getting a strategic partner," he says. "Biotechs in general are not getting a good reception from equities investors," he says, adding that the hot IPOs right now are cloud-based companies, not biotech. This week's guest opinion is Mr. Ralph Davidson. Mr. Davidson is a senior consultant for Carney, Sandow, and Associates in Boston. Greatness is seeing, showing the way. How do you know when you are in the presence of a great person? You know, the kind of person we're talking about, someone whose life is literally extraordinary, someone who inspires all of us to be better at life than we ever thought we could be. In early March, I had the chance to be in the presence of such a great man. A group of more than 4,200 educators were gathered in Seattle for the annual meeting of the National Association of Independent Schools. The theme of our meeting was Innovation, Imagine, Invent, Inspire, Dream. Bernie Ngo, head of Lakeside School in Seattle, introduced the keynote speaker, a Lakeside alumnus. Because of the work of his foundation, so far the lives of 5 million children have been saved. By 2015, we hope that this figure will be $20 million. Then Bill Gates walked on the stage. He was almost shy and self-effacing, but within moments, his intelligence and clarity of vision captured everyone present. "Encourage people to make the lives of others better, especially those who have the odds stacked against them," he began. He sees a powerful path to better lives through education using technology. "Technology doesn't substitute for the teacher, but it makes the material fun, personal, and relevant for the individual student," he says. Gates has helped to revolutionize the world of education by creating innovative devices and programs. Because of his work, many teachers have learned to reinvent their own profession through technological advances. They are reimagining textbooks through such programs as Inkling. They are what he calls scaling our best teachers through iTunes U. They are connecting through social networks such as Edmodo. And they are personalizing learning through programs such as Manga High and Khan Academy. Gates also spoke about the Global Online Academy, but he recognizes that using technology for universal learning has its challenges. Not all families can afford a personal computer. Reliability of hardware must improve. When some kids go home, they do not have access to the Internet. We need to give teachers time to catch up and learn how to use all this technology. And this approach to teaching and learning needs to work for all students and not just to accentuate the divide between those who do well and those who do not. What does he envision the result of all this will be for our country's education in the future? Gates predicts that education will be better for everyone. Textbooks without paper will replace paper textbooks. Cost savings will be redirected to fund investments in increased technology, creating an interactive, personalized, and better learning environment for all students. He isn't predicting that face-to-face interaction with teachers will vanish, far from it, because it is important for teachers to know their students and how they can best learn. But the nature of learning will radically improve as technology brings flexible, personal, interactive, and high-quality content to all. Triangle Business Journal likes to check in on ESPN.com's power rankings of National Hockey League teams. In the latest ranking, posted March 19th, the Carolina Hurricanes came in at number 22 in the 30-team league, up three spots from the week before, with good reason. Had the Canes been playing as they have of late from day one of the season, they likely would have clinched a playoff spot by now. Here's what ESPN's Scott Burnside wrote about the late-season incarnation of our hometown team. Quote, strong play down the stretch, 5-2-2 in their last nine, including a shutout of the Red Hot Blues and a big win in Winnipeg. Isn't doing much to help the Canes' draft position, but it does bode well for the future. Food for thought, the Canes were just 5 points out of eighth as of Monday. End quote. Also, Seems new RDU Airport Director Michael Langeth is a believer in ongoing training. Under his first budget, senior managers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport and employees in several departments would spend more time on professional development. The budget is expected to be approved on March 22nd by the airport's governing board. The budget increases the airport's spending on employee tuition assistance to $77,000 in the fiscal year that begins April 1st. That's up from $20,000 in the current fiscal year. Spending on other professional development is slated to rise from $197,000 to $211,000. Also, Smithmore Leatherwood attorney Brad Reisinger has been named chairman of United Way of North Carolina, a charity that funds a range of other charities and nonprofit groups. Mr. Reisinger is a partner in the firm's Raleigh office. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.